This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, three goblins walk into a bar. Humour in speculative fiction and avoiding the accidental funny.
So I kind of want to hear the end of that joke.
Three so goblins do I. I'm going to have to think of a good pun.
I said I wanted a joke, not a pun.
Well, that's
always
a good...
There's always one person in your friend group who seems to exist on puns, isn't there?
Yes.
And it's almost physically painful, but at the same time you have to appreciate sometimes. Well, I had one, which was that I was in France recently, and we went to see this castle, and they had these stocks up at the back, you know, which you could just take a picture in as you do. So I thought, well, yeah, why not? So I took a picture of me in the stocks. And put it up, and I said, what do you guys think of this photograph? And one of my friends just went, Madeleine, a stock photograph.
Do you know, that's exactly what I was thinking as you were saying that. That makes me just as bad.
But it's obvious when you're spelling it out, but you know, if you don't really think of the word stocks, you... So I was like, oh, you, but okay, I'm going to give you that because it was quite a good pun.
I don't know. I'm somebody who will have a conversation and not realise until they are well into deep waters with the conversation that if whoever's listening is holding themselves together and trying not to laugh, because I've sort of ventured down, well, not so much pun central, but it's more a case of it sounds really, really bad. Matt and I were having a conversation the other night. He may well be doing another collaborative project with another author. And I made a jokey comment about, yeah, well, I'm not sure I think that much about so-and-so stealing my co-writer. And he said, it's only just going to be for this one project. And I said, well, he better return you in good working condition. And it went on down that road. And then Shell just chipped in with, you do realise it doesn't sound like you're talking about writing and hasn't for some time. At which point both Matt and I went, oh yeah, it kind of does sound like I'm trafficking him, doesn't it?
Well, to be honest, I think that we really don't need to look any further than our own terrible sense of humour when it comes to the naming of each of these episodes.
Yeah.
I do have to say, I can claim quite a lot of responsibility for some of the terrible titles that have come up onto the up onto Dissecting Dragons. Jules also has you know, some responsibility. She named this one, so you know, that's on her.
This is a solid title, come on. In all fairness, yeah. Madeleine is very good at reining me in. The episode, not so charming, I actually wanted to call Of Nice and Men, but I was told that I wasn't allowed that one, so.
I drew a line. I said no. Of Nice and Men. I purged that from my mind and now you've reminded me.
You're supposed to go away forever. Okay, so humour and speculative fiction arguably could potentially be more difficult than humour in fiction set in a modern setting, or even humour set in an historical setting.
Yeah.
And part of the reason for that is that even though you do have some crossover with things that, you know, exist in this imaginary world and our current world, there's an awful lot of things that don't cross over. So you really have to be, I suppose, quite creative setting up the humour.
Yeah. And
at the same time, depending on what you're writing, you need to make sure that the humour doesn't actually distract from the story.
Yeah. And especially when you're building up entirely new worlds and the humour is based within an inside joke within the world itself. So it's based on the laws of the world, it's based on sort of an established kind of structure. You also have to make sure that the humour doesn't get too complicated.
Yeah.
In some ways.
Yeah, absolutely.
It is at risk of doing.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Obviously the established master is Terry Pratchett, and
yeah.
What he was particularly good at doing was delivering very, very painful topics in a way that made you laugh, but also allowed you to think about the topic. I don't think anybody else has quite managed such a delicate balancing act since, but I'll give you one example. Monstrous Regiment is set in a very, very small country that's basically warring with all of its neighbours. And they're starting to run out of men to have in the army, ultimately. Anyway, Polly, who is a barmaid, basically decides that she needs to get her brother back from the war because she needs somebody to run the bar. So she disguises herself as a boy and joins the army, having heard several old ballads to that effect. On her first day, I mean, she thinks she's doing quite well signing up so far, and then she's even learned how to pee standing up, which is, contrary to popular belief, that is something you can do as a woman. It just takes a little bit of, flexibility and, well, we won't go into it. We won't go into it. It can be done. It can be done. So she's in the bathroom stall, and there's the so that someone speaks through the little divider next to her and says, "You're doing all right so far, lass. You've given the absolute impression of a scared green lad." And Polly's feeling a bit sort of, "I did not act scared, you know." He's like, "The trouble is, your disguise is missing one thing." And she's thinking, "Oh God, what is it? They're going to find out I'm a woman. I'm going to be executed." And this hand appears under the stall door and hands her a rolled up pair of socks and says, "You know where they need to go, lass." And then from there on, it's a brilliantly set up line where socks, obviously being, the word for testicles, just becomes the in joke. And it's like, well, I dare you to do it because I just don't think you've got the socks. And it runs throughout the entire book, and it is extremely funny, which is great. And there are other puns and things in there. And one of the best reveals, probably in humorous fantasy, is the bit where they find out that everyone in Polly's regiment is in fact a woman, including the sergeant. But the thing is, it does deal with some very painful topics. It deals with the fact that the women are completely subjugated in this country. They don't have options to do anything except marry or work in a particular job if their parents happen to be wealthy enough, or go into prostitution, or go into a girls' home. The abuses and things that take place in the sort of girls' homes are horrific, and they're all supposed to be wearing, they're supposed to be wearing Sunday veils and things like that. That there's a religious overtone as well, and it's all very, very much about control, and it's as much control against the men as it is against the women in a different way. And it's depicted beautifully, and the humour actually allows you to look at it without becoming so depressed that you just think, "I'm going to put the book down."
One thing, it's a quote from his name's just gone, Joss Whedon, where he was talking about writing darkness and stuff like that. He said, make your audience suffer, make them hurt, and then for God's sake tell a joke. Which I think is actually really crucial in that there's a marriage, there's a reason you have, a black humor, as it's called. There's this marriage between very serious topics and humor. And the way that we deal with bad things happening is often with humor, which is why, some of the saddest films you watch will have moments which actually have you in tears. And it's why actually a lot of comedies will then sometimes have this balance of suddenly very sad and very real moments. I was watching MASH the other day. And they're joking around, but at the end of the day, they're at war, and every now and again, some very serious things start to happen.
It just sort of reminds you of that last episode, the last scene, the last episode of the fourth season of Blackadder,
Of Blackadder,
where
yeah.
they go over the top and it's all been really, really funny, and then they sort of stopped and you end on that, the poppies and the music being played
Yeah.
slightly differently. And it's like, yes, we've been making fun of this, and we've been quite scathing, and it's been funny. But at the same time, what was it? We couldn't have been more successful at killing our own men if we'd stood them up and slaughtered them 20,000 a week.
Yeah.
Yeah, it sort of really hits home at that point. For those of you who haven't watched Blackadder, go and watch Blackadder. Blackadder the Fourth is about the First World War.
It's an incredible series. Anyway, it's not speculative, so we won't talk about that.
No.
But yeah, Terry Pratchett actually does write about some very serious issues, which undertone a lot of it, of his humorous works. And you almost miss it sometimes because he interweaves jokes. I'm trying to think of it. Of course, all the examples that I had prepared have just flown out of my head. But I mean, on the simpler side, the dealing with mortality is something that Terry Pratchett did a lot of.
Absolutely. And dealing with the real cesspool parts of human nature.
Yeah.
And it's done in a really funny way. And it's not a case of the really bad guys particularly get punished as such, although a lot of them do come to quite sticky ends. I'm thinking of things like Small Gods, which again is absolutely hilarious. I mean, if you think of the last published Terry Pratchett book, The Shepherd's Crown, it starts off with Tiffany Aching, who is the young witch, coming into a power and coming into her full adulthood, feeling a little bit lost, to be honest, and yeah. Facing up against one of the people in her holdings.
Yeah.
And this is a man who basically beat his daughter to the point where she lost her baby. And I won't say he makes a big joke out of it, but the way that Tiffany is reacting has enough dark humour in it that you're not sat there going, oh my god, this is terrible. But it is terrible.
Yeah.
And it is the sort of, you know, it's not a laughing matter. And it is being treated in a sensitive way, but it's also, once again, it just allows you that slight remove so that you can look at it and say, no, that really is awful. It's funny, but this is awful.
Yeah. And I think often in cases like that, that is when humour works the best. And I think what happens is that humour starts to fail, especially in speculative fiction, when things are taken too seriously. And so you get unintentional humour when you start to really take yourself far too seriously.
And hence the accidental funny. And a lot of writers don't realise that they've put these in there.
Yeah.
It's only when someone else is reading it and starts laughing. And I'm a dreadful one for doing this with grand sweeping romantic scenes, unfortunately.
Well, one I love, which I really loved reading Lord of the Rings all those years back. And I was reminded of this recently, a sort of post about it, where Aragorn has his ear to the ground and he's listening out, and he's been listening for a while, and he's just there like, there are riders approaching, you know. He makes this grand statement, and Legolas goes, yes, there are riders approaching, and they are fair-haired and have like brown eyes or something like that. And I was there like, you little he's just let Aragorn lie on the ground and cold ground, you know, they've been hunting. He's letting Aragorn, and Aragorn's there like, I think I can hear something, and Legolas has been able to see them for ages. And obviously that was meant to be it was meant to showcase Legolas's ability. It wasn't meant to be funny, but it was hilarious because I just thought, it doesn't make any sense unless Legolas is just a real asshole.
Oh, the jury's out on that one, but
I think you have an example of that as well, don't you? Of something which was meant to be serious.
Yeah, there's a couple. One of them is, this continually happens with Terry Goodkind. Everything is dark, really, really, you know, dark, it's bleak, it's bad, everything bad is happening. And then suddenly he'll just break away from the narrative and pontificate for about 6 or 7 pages about some weird, like, tiny political bylaw or something. And I think this sort of reached its peak in The Faith of the Fallen, which is something like the 7th book.
Yeah.
Whereby, you know, having finally got back together with Caelan, Richard Rahl gets kidnapped by a sorceress again. Seriously, Terry Goodkind lets them sleep together like 3 times in the entire series. Anyway, he gets kidnapped, taken off to the enemy country.
The enemy country?
I can't remember what it's called. It's awful. It's got out of my head. And slowly, you know, ponderously, with glacial precision, the Emperor Zhigang is sort of invading the rest of the free, so-called free country. And Richard Rahl's trapped there, even though he's a war wizard. It's really amazing, actually, how Richard's powers only really manifest when he's facing an entire army by himself. Otherwise, he's completely helpless. But that aside, there's a
Yeah.
bit where he's basically been housed in what seems to be a slum upstairs, and the great aspiration of the boys in that society is to grow up, firstly, and secondly, to join the army where they will be able to have food and women and do whatever they want, etc. They're being taught at a very early age that you do not treat women with respect, etc., etc. So that's a side note, but this is what the society's like. Richard somehow improves that entire society in 5 minutes flat by fixing a stair.
Oh, well done, Richard.
Now I'm pretty sure, because it's fascinating. There's a broken stair which someone might injure themselves on, and Richard sits down because once upon a time, he was a woodsman and, does knows how to make things carpentry wise. And he just sits down and he fixes the staircase, and people stop what they're doing and come and watch because they've never seen anyone fix anything before. Now, I'm sure what Terry Goodkind is getting at is the whole broken window theory, whereby if you have one broken window on a street, then you're far more likely to have instances of vandalism and violence and progressively worse crime. Whereby if you have one broken window and somebody fixes it immediately, then you're far less likely to have that gradual progression down the line. I'm sure that's what he was getting at. What it comes across as, this is a terrible society, but if we all fix one stair, we'll completely change the entire mindset of a country. Ta-da! And it's
Ta-da!
just, I was just sat there. I ended up paging through the book looking for, like, how, what? Like, what's going on? What does this have to do with the main arc? There's an army somewhere doing terrible, horrible things, and you're doing what? Indulging a little bit of carpentry? Why are you not trying to escape? So you've got to be careful with your sidebars, is what I'm saying. The other example is actually it's Sarah J. Maas, and it's the Throne of Glass series. I haven't read the last book, but I did see the main character Selena is okay, but I find her fighting somewhat unbelievable. I find her reasoning a bit laughable. And she's had five, four, sorry, four, I haven't quite gone to five yet, four one true loves by this point. And this latest one, it was something so over traumatic. It was like something along the lines of, and we could make the universe or unmake it as we desired because we were so connected and in love. And it was like, that's supposed to be really dramatic and romantic. Instead, what it sounds like is really, really bad fan fiction.
I haven't read it, so I can't judge, but I couldn't get into Throne of Glass.
I mean, they do get better. The first one's a little bit shaky, but when you consider how amazing her Court of Thorns and Roses series is, by comparison, it's just like that they could have been written by two different writers.
Different stages of her writing life, so
Yeah, which is fair. Anyway, I'm going back to humour that does actually work. I quite like Mark Lawrence, who wrote the Broken Empire series and the Red Queen's War. And particularly with the Red Queen's War, he's got Jaylen the Red Prince, who is hilarious. And Jaylen is a coward and a trickster, and he lies and cheats and sleeps around a lot and would rather just be drinking a lot of wine than doing anything. He is the ultimate reluctant hero, but he's extremely funny as well when he's doing it.
I think very often the funniest characters are the sarcastic ones.
Yeah, I mean he's a little bit sarcastic, but it's more sort of that dry wit as well. It's
Yeah,
like, I've always regarded boats as thin planks of wood between oneself and drowning when asked to set sail on what is basically a Viking longship.
He's not wrong.
No, he's not technically wrong. But it feeds very well into his reluctant hero persona, which is why it does it so well, I think.
The other thing. The reason actually humor especially is incredibly important within, and especially within epic fantasy, is that epic fantasy obviously by nature is meant to be fantastical, and it's meant to transport you away from normal life. That's what we look for when we pick up fantasy. We want to be transported away from the everyday. However, in order to have a very successful book, you need to meet a basic amount of criteria, which is that your content still needs to be relatable enough whereby your reader can read it and feel like they are going on the journey as well. If you totally alienate your reader, you're not going to be able, it becomes very difficult for them to insert themselves into this world. So the ways you do that is that you make characters have flaws the reader can associate with. The characters themselves, they can be riding a dragon, but occasionally they feel funny about how they look. These are the small little things like that are what are the doorway in that allow us to exist through these characters into these magical sort of worlds. And humor is a tremendous part of that, I think. And allowing humor and allowing wit and allowing characters, especially who are a little bit unwilling, is another key, really big entrance in for us as readers into this world, which makes it more believable and makes it more real for us.
Yeah, absolutely. It can't all just be all darkness all the time. Depending on what sort of fantasy you're writing, it can't just be all just one gag after another either, because then it just becomes slapstick. And after a while, I mean, everyone's got an end point for how much slapstick they can tolerate in one sitting. In my case, it's two lines, and that's it. In fact, two lines might be being a bit generous for just slapstick with not much content around it. Can't stand it.
Yeah, no, I have a problem with it as well. I think the only slapstick series I've ever been able to watch is Black Books.
Yeah, but that
And I
was
think
really
it's because
clever as well.
it's quite clever. And I think I think the reason I could sort of bear Black Books was that it's almost basically a comedy show, rather as in like a comedy stand-up rather than just I don't quite know why it is I'm able to bear Black Books, but I think it's probably the genius of
Dylan Moran.
Dylan Moran, who's an exceptional, and Bill Bailey, obviously, and the woman, the actress who plays Fran,
Yeah,
is
and
very good.
together they all deliver it very well. It's a bit like Spaced, if you've ever seen that. And Red Dwarf in its golden days might not be your type of humour, but there was a lot of slapstick in there, but behind the slapstick was a lot of intelligence. And a lot of the stuff that happens to the characters is really horrific. You know, if you didn't give it a humorous context, it would be like awful. It's when Dave Lister wakes up on the ship the first time, and the only companion he's got at that precise moment is Holly, the ship's computer, which is basically an AI. And Dave's walking around the ship, sort of touching these little piles of dust, going, "What about so and so? And so and so?" And Holly's going, "Everybody's dead, Dave. Everybody's dead, Dave. Everybody's dead, Dave. Dave, everybody is dead. Everybody is dead, Dave."
I thought, doesn't he start eating the dust?
He starts sampling it to see what it is. And he said, "What, even Captain Hollister?" And Holly goes, "Yes, that's Captain Hollister right there." And he goes, "What, this pile of dust? Oh my God, I've sampled half the And it is horrific when you think about it, because it's something like 3 million years into the future, and 20,000 people are now piles of dust apart from Dave Lister. And he's just been kind of eating them. That is so funny. And I mean, it's obviously, if that actually theoretically happened, presumably you would have as much difficulty processing that level of destruction and the fact that you were the last human alive as he was having. And you know, he's quite chilled about it, really. But when you really think about it, it's like that should bring on a major case of existential angst for me, and it doesn't, because it's delivered in such a funny way.
I couldn't. I watched a few episodes of Red Dwarf, but I never really got into it too much. Again, probably. I don't know why. Because I'm not very good at shows where everything resets at the three sets. At the end of every episode, so nothing gets achieved.
Well, I have to say that doesn't happen with Red Dwarf.
Oh, okay.
They do progress. It's a much longer, wider arc, but the characters do change, and the characters do develop things, and the friendships do change as well. They actually become friendships for a start.
Well, I you watched Gallivant, didn't you?
No, I don't think so.
Did you not watch Gallivant? Gallivant was an incredible. It was a TV. It's a TV series. Hopefully, they're going to get another season. they may be picked up. Which it's a musical. It's a musical TV series, and it's hilarious. I highly recommend it. It's very, very funny. And one of the ways they did humor there was through the breaking of the fourth wall. The breaking of the fourth wall is actually a lot trickier than you assume that it's going to be. You know, you can't just necessarily break the fourth wall and that makes it funny.
No, because then you'd end up with a pantomime.
Yeah, and you know that, but even if you know you are aiming for a pantomime-esque kind of thing, there's ways in which to break the fourth wall which actually sort of really do make it humorous. And so, for instance, right at the beginning of Gallivant, they sing this long song about the fact that they're off on a journey and they climb this hill, and then they get to the end, and Gallivant just doubles over and just goes, "Oh, I'm out of breath." Oh, and the others, because he's really unfit at that point, and they all look at him, and he just goes, "Whew, that was a long song." And I just thought it was genius because it was so, you don't usually acknowledge songs in musicals; they
No,
just kind of happen.
well, no, that's the whole point, isn't it? Because they're just there to move the plot along, so.
Exactly. The other one is that they're singing at one point, and one of the characters is actually a traitor, and she just says, "And I hope he doesn't find out I'm working for the king." And Gallivant goes, "What? What did you just say?" And she goes, "Nothing." I just thought it was, because he actually stops and he goes, "Wait, hold on, hold on. I just heard you say something." And so the timing, the comedic timing of that was incredibly impressive. It is incredibly difficult, and it's especially incredibly difficult when you're doing it in writing, because a lot of the breaking of the fourth wall is done through tone. And so you have to be careful when you're doing it. And you, first of all, you can't do it like in a TV series where only occasionally they break the fourth wall and it's okay. When you're doing it for a book, you need to set up that tone right from the beginning, because otherwise it just feels jarring. You just suddenly go, "I don't understand what's happened," because you cannot anticipate the tone in which your reader is going to be reading it unless you have set up that tone throughout the work.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an interesting thought, though, looking at breaking the fourth wall, and talking about musicals doing it. I mean, technically, the musical episode of Buffy, they do that. Just a little bit. And when you think, if you were to take the music out of that and just make it an ordinary Buffy episode, that would be an incredibly dark episode. Because you would have, obviously, you've got someone summoning a demon, you've got possible child bride trafficking in the underworld. You've got Buffy, who's in a real bad state of depression because she's just been ripped out of heaven. And the fact that Willow has a serious addiction to magic going on and has been messing with her girlfriend's memory. And because the music's in it, I wouldn't say it makes it happy, but it gives it a different tone, as you say. And there are the odd lines here and there which are clearly addressed at the audience, like Willow saying, "I think this line's mostly filler." Just because it's like, well, I've got a line, but there's nothing to it. I have to say it, but.
I feel we can't talk about breaking of the fourth wall and humor of breaking the fourth wall without talking about Deadpool.
I was just thinking that. Yeah. Let's talk about Deadpool.
Deadpool.
Deadpool, for those who are fans of the Marvel Universe, is probably one of the more risque superheroes. And
Yeah, a
certainly
little bit.
more one of the more risque films that have been made. And I'm actually glad that they did it.
Yeah, me too. I think they did it very well.
Deadpool, the character, is pansexual. Seems to have a real thing about unicorns, which I don't entirely approve of, because I don't know if the unicorns are consenting or not, but
One would presume.
one would presume. Anyway, he is a really, really great character.
And incredibly dark.
Yes.
I mean, he's a merc, and he murders people. You know, you look at the movie, a lot of people die in that movie.
Oh, God,
He's
yeah.
tortured. Everyone, pretty much all of his friends are killed. He's tortured. He murders a bunch of people. Without the humor, that would just be so intensely dark.
Well, there's the point where at near the grand battle at the end where the villain says, you do not call me that," and he said, "Okay, hold on a second," and he kills all the guy's men and then spells out the villain's name, his real name, in bodies. And the special point is that he dots the I by beheading one of them and putting the head in the position of the dot on an lowercase I. And I'm like, is
Yeah,
that attention to detail that I can really appreciate in a character?
that's right. Yeah, you've got to love Deadpool. You've got to love Deadpool. Another case where of a book which is written which breaks the fourth wall because it's written in first person a narrative is The Dresden Files. You ever read The Dresden Files?
No, I've got a couple on my to be read pile, actually.
I fell in love with the Dresden Files. When I first read the Dresden Files, they opened up an entirely new way of writing, which got me into writing something called the Kestrel Saga, which it was the first time ever I came across writing, which, you know, I'd read first person before, but it was the first time I came across this idea that you could just write within your own voice, if that makes sense. You could write with how you speak, how you actually are. You didn't have to rein it in. You didn't have to become a slightly stuffy narrator to do it. The narration itself could be a voice, and I'd never seen it done so well before. So I read the Dresden Files and I fell in love with it, and I started my own urban fantasy series. Several years later, I started it. But this, yeah, the Dresden Files was the first instance where I saw this done in a fantastic way. And then I read Good Omens, which I'm pretty sure is also
Terry
tis
Pratchett and
also
Neil
done.
Gaiman.
Yeah, Neil Gaiman, but it's done in first person, isn't it?
No,
I'm not
it's
imagining that, am I?
narrated. It is an omniscient third person narrator.
Yeah, but sorry, but the narrator is also kind of, well, obviously it's their version of narration, which means that it's not a the narrator is actually quite funny.
That is something that you do find with Terry Pratchett particularly, and Neil Gaiman to a certain extent, is that both of them at some point, the omniscient third person narrator, the free and direct style, if you like,
Yeah.
takes on a little bit more personality and seems to address you directly and then fade gently back again, and it's very, very clever. So
Yeah.
yeah.
So I started writing a series, and don't know where it went
And Kestrel's a really, really great character. And
from there.
I mean, you can't just have a character who's made of sarcasm because then they just become embittered and they're not interesting to follow. But having someone who is grudging, she's not just a reluctant hero, she's a grudging hero. She's like, yes, I know I can do it, but I don't want to, and I'm having to do it anyway because you're all incompetent type feel.
She, I mean, Kestrel, I wrote a line a while back. It's in the first book, whereby she's something bad's happened. She has to sort of sort it out, and Galahad, her partner, just says, "Self-pitying it doesn't become you." And she said, "Oh, self-pity." And then she goes, "Yeah, I suppose it is self-pity, you know. But all these terrible things have happened. God forbid I feel, you know, pity about it." And Galahad's saying, no, you're allowed to feel bad about it, but I just, you know, you feel this bad about it. Why don't you let me take some of the responsibility?" And she just goes, "Yeah, well, okay, it's my friends who've been kidnapped. It's my family who've been, you know, attacked, and it's my quest that I've been given. So I'm gonna do it. And my obligation to do it goes hand in hand with my ability to bitch about it, basically." So she's just said, "So we're going to complete this quest, and I'm going to complain the entire time, but we're going to do it." And I think it's probably because that's what I'm like to a certain degree. I'm like, I'm going to do it, but you know, I am going to complain until it's done. And then when it's done, you're like, "Oh, it wasn't too bad," but it was that bad. It was always that bad.
And this
And
is
then.
something that actually we kind of got to explore a bit when we did our writing weekend a few weeks ago.
We did. It was great fun. I didn't realize it, but basically pretty much every single Kestrel Saga story starts with her complaining. I didn't mean for it to happen like
It was witches,
that. She's
Galahad,
just the bloody
obviously.
witches. Yeah, she hates witches because they're always thwarting her. No, but it literally does. Pretty much every episode starts. Every episode, every story I've started so far starts with her complaining about something. For instance, the Kestrel and the Kryptonites in Stalking Leviathan anthology, which is now available if anyone hasn't read it yet. It's an anthology of creatures and cryptids. It starts with her complaining about the fact that they've got to go and do this job, and she's complaining, and then she almost trips over. And then in our short story, she's complaining about the fact that it's too cold. And then Galahad says, yeah, but you said it was too warm a few weeks ago. And she's just there like, shut up. So yeah, I don't know why, but she complains a lot.
And then, of course, Emlyn turns up, and she has plenty to complain
Yeah, it's funny because I love this is an example of where humor can sort of betray you in some ways, because I love Emmeline as a character. I love her and I really want Kestrel to be friends with her, but right now Kestrel is just being really horrible to
It
Emmeline.
is mutual, in fairness, because she doesn't think very much of Kestrel either, and
No,
they're
she
really
called her
rubbing each other
short.
up the wrong way.
She called her short, and
Who's
I feel
5 foot 10?
so betrayed by
So,
that.
hopefully we'll get to finish that at some point, and they might even be sort of vaguely on good terms by the end of that story.
I genuinely hope so, because I need them to be friends. But yeah, writing humor in that way is it requires. I think the reason it's successful, and I say, I'm saying successful. I don't know. Other people, it seems to be that other people have found the Kestrel saga funny, I hope. I've certainly enjoyed writing it, but I think the main element of the humour is literally born of the fact that I got to write this character who isn't particularly nice, first of all. The best description, and I'm going to swear here, I'm sorry, was my friend described her, and he said, Kestrel's a bitch. She is a wonderful, beautiful bitch, was how he described her, and I thought that that was a wonderful description. I'm going to go personal here. Humor in writing, and finding humor in your own writing is incredibly hard, and especially if you're a woman as well, there's a sexism to it, whereby we're taught that men are funnier than women. Not necessarily explicitly that's what we're taught, but we see a lot of male comedians, and women don't help that either. We don't support other female comedians and stuff like that. You don't see a lot of female comedians or anything along those lines. We're
And
not
then
considered.
when you do, it's a big issue. Like, someone, the exclamation I hear most often is, she's actually funny, a woman who's actually funny. It's like, well, of course she is. Women can be funny. There might be less opportunity, and I think there probably is, but.
When I was a while back, I dated somebody. This is a personal story. I dated someone who had a very different sense of humor to me, and they told me to stop telling jokes because I wasn't funny. And I think they were doing it, I say it, they were doing it as if I was embarrassing myself, and they, it was their responsibility to tell me I was not a funny person. And I believed them. And that destroyed a part of me for a very long time. And I didn't realize actually how much it did, how significant that was as a blow, that I was with somebody who never laughed at my jokes, didn't find me funny, and actually, said it, said, t told me that I wasn't funny. And so the things I was writing, that I stopped trying to insert jokes, and I stopped trying because I thought no one is going to get these, no one is going to appreciate them. If I'm giggling at them, no one else is going to. And then a few years later, it was actual years, I spoke to somebody who said to me, promise me that whatever you do in your life, you'll use your humor. And I said, well, I don't think I'd be a very good comedian, dismissing it. And that he said, you don't need to be a comedian. You're a funny person, and you can insert that in different ways. And I didn't realize actually how much I had betrayed myself. And from that moment on, I started writing. That's really actually around that time that I started writing the Kestrel saga. And I started writing Kestrel in her original conception was just she was me. She was me, but un. Oh, what's the word? unrestrained. She was me, but unrestrained. She was all of the bad thoughts that I had, all of the, you know, the nasty things that I think that you wouldn't ever say. And then she was more of that.
Yeah.
And I released it out into the world and people liked her. And that changed everything for me. So I think one thing I can say to writers, and specifically to female writers, is that, yeah, there will be jokes that you tell that are going to fall flat. And telling jokes is hard, and creating humour and writing is hard. God knows, for every good joke in Kestrel Saga, there were several terrible, awful jokes that fell totally flat. And it took a long time to shape, and it took a long time to get right. And humour is almost, it is harder to write, I think, than seriousness sometimes. And finding the balance is very tricky. But
yeah.
For the love of God, don't give up on yourself.
No, and I think the thing with humour is, you, to really write it effectively, you have to be willing to laugh at yourself.
Yeah.
In the first place. And it's a case of, well, I'm taking my writing seriously, but I'm not taking it to the nth degree of seriousness.
Yeah.
Whereby I can't see that actually this is kind of funny as well.
Yeah.
This is, there's an element of ridiculousness about this, because that's life. Horrible, horrible things can be happening, and part of you will be sat there going, yeah, but this is utterly ridiculous at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Definitely.
Do everything with a pinch of humour, guys.
But it is more difficult. When people are really trying to be funny with their writing, it doesn't come off as well, because I think it lacks, once again, emotional honesty.
Yeah.
Which seems to be the hinge point of good writing for everything. Kestrel's great, and it's not just snappy retorts, it's how she looks at the world as well. That's really funny.
I'm glad. That it's heartwarming. Kestrel has obviously gone out into the world. At the moment, she's the first short story that's ever been published with Kestrel. as we said, it's in Stalking Leviathan. And then at some point, I will unleash the first book upon the world. So, fingers crossed, it's well received.
So I think most of my humour, unfortunately, comes from Grace, which is really bad.
Grace is quite funny, though.
But she is a complete... Wait, she is funny, but she's also kind of a bitch.
Yeah, we have really bitchy characters.
But at the very, very early draft stage of I Belong to the Earth, when I was talking with a self-editing group, so not even a writing group, a self-editing group, and there's a bit where she, Emmeline's met Hayes for the first time, and it's, you know, it's like, this is bad kind of thing. She can tell there's something wrong with him. And she's trying to say, who are you? But it comes out as who, because she stutters. And Grace says, God, Gremlin, you sound like a retarded owl. And I thought, that's, you know, moderately funny. But it had the self-editing group in stitches. And I'm like, well, I thought it was vaguely funny. I didn't think it was that funny.
It's so un-PC. I hate that word, but I do hate the R word, but I did laugh a lot when I read that line.
And it's like, it's just, that was a really, really horrible thing to say
to
your sister in front of a stranger, but it's so what she would do.
Yeah, it was very, very typical of Grace, and very typical of kind of thing that you'd say to a sibling. But I did like the owl. Awful, but funny. I think that's the only correct way you can deal with those things.
I think that's it. That is it, isn't it? Some humour that makes people really laugh. It kind of hurts at the same time.
Yeah.
But Grace's shameless plug. Grace has her own novella out now, and
yeah,
she's
does.
Kind of a bitch all the way through that as well.
She has some great comebacks in though. She has some fantastic comebacks. I do like her.
I mean, she's trying to work on her character a bit since I Belong to the Earth, so she's constantly chanting, be nice, Grace. Just be nice to herself. And then someone will do something really stupid, and it's kind of like, yes, I can be a bitch now.
She does. She does actually have some excellent little retorts.
I went through it and edited it and formatted it, and I know what's written, and I was still laughing. Which makes you wonder about my sense of humour, probably.
No. I think, yeah, final parting word is that when you when you're writing your own stuff, it's okay to laugh at your own jokes as you're reading back through them.
I mean, in fact, your own jokes should make you laugh. If they don't make you laugh, why would they make anyone else laugh?
Yeah,
It's like,
unless it's the 50th time you're reading it, in which case, fair enough if you don't, if you're not in stitches.
it's the same as anything else. Writing something scary should, at least give you that sort of being watched goosebumps feeling. Or I so want to know how you coped with writing the Corrigans. This is a complete aside. I'm going to have to ask you afterwards because it's not part of this podcast.
No, it's not part of the podcast.
But yeah, and the sad stuff. Okay, maybe it wouldn't necessarily have you in tears, but it kind of should be pushing you in that direction.
That's actually, this is an example of a joke that did fall flat in my case that I wrote because the build-up wasn't good enough and because I didn't use the rule of three. For anyone who knows about Commedia dell'arte, look up Commedia dell'arte, first of all, it's hilarious. It's an old Italian, tis Italian, I think, theatrical style, which was slapstick, and it would have the Harlecchino character, so Truffaldino in the case of A Servant to Two Masters, which was a play that I studied. And they had these archetypes and they were very funny. And then there was the Harlecchino character was basically the main character. And you will recognize the Harlecchino character because you see him a lot of slapstick now. He's the opportunist. He's a little bit dumb, but he's quite smart in another way. He's a lovable idiot who gets himself into situations out of greed or stuff like that. And everything, of course, spirals out of control before he knows what's happening, and he goes from one harebrained idea to another. But the Harlecchino character, there was a rule of three, which again we see, which is that you do the same thing twice, and then the third time it's different, and that's kind of what makes it funny. You can't. It doesn't work for four. It doesn't work for two. Yeah, it needs to be the rule of three. Works across comedy. And in my case, I didn't do the build-up properly. I didn't really mention it three times or anything like that. And that was a joke that some people found funny in The Sons of Thespian and some people didn't. And it was right early on, Jonathan is unraveling this blanket and Rufus says, "What are you doing?" And Jonathan said, "Well, it's for the Corrigan's nest." And Rufus just goes, "Ah, oh, I see. You're going to bribe the Corrigans with yarn." And without blinking, Jonathan just goes, "Yeah, I'm going to bribe the Corrigans with yarn." And what he's doing is that he's doing it. They're doing an Ariadne, Theseus, Theseus kind of thing. It is Theseus, yeah. Where they're planning on putting the rope out behind them so that they can find their way out. And then when they're in the nest, they see the Corrigans, and Jonathan just goes, "Anyone want any yarn?" But the joke didn't work. It didn't work in the way that it was done. The setup didn't work. It had been too long. There'd been too many chapters between, and it wasn't built up properly. So some people said, "Yeah, I really liked it," and other people said, "Nah, it ruined the total atmosphere of what you were trying to create." So I got rid of it in the. It's not in the second edition anymore.
It is that's the thing that's quite difficult though. I had feedback from an agent once who said, "You've got some really funny lines, but you keep putting them in the wrong place." And she was saying it about again, that chapter where we meet Hayes for the first time.
Yeah.
And Amy being Amy has just sort of got in Hayes's face and said, "You must have a second name. Only popes and rock stars don't have second names, and you don't look like either." And of course, Emmeline's there thinking, not strictly true on the rock star front, Amy, but full marks for trying. But the problem was, that line worked okay. The problem was, I tried to insert something funny in the horror before that, and it totally detracted from that line, so some of it got cut out.
Yeah.
So there's a bit that's now missing from that that actually is better off gone, because you need that whole sort of, oh my God, what's happening? Why can't anyone see all the
Yeah.
shadows and things surrounding him? This is awful. I think I feel like I'm falling, kind of, and not in a good way, thing. And then, of course, you've got, as a complete contrast, Amy just being 13-year-old sister with, it's like, I don't like you looking at my older sister like that, kind of thing.
Yeah, it's all comedic timing, and that's the other hard thing, which is that your characters may have a different sense of comedic timing than you do as the narrator. Which means that you can be trying to write a serious scene and then your character comes out with some, in this case, yeah. Character comes out with something which is, you're like, no, it's not the appropriate time, but this is something you'd say. And yeah, and it's about finding that balance. So yeah, but yes, guys, if you try to keep everything serious in a piece of writing, you will very quickly find that the seriousness becomes funny because it's taking itself too seriously.
And it'll become funny in a way you don't intend. Or you'll just end up with a really stodgy piece of writing ultimately, and you'll probably find yourself getting bored with it, which is the other thing that might happen. And I think that's where I mentioned last week I got really, really stuck on book two, and I kept getting to this one scene, and I just couldn't get any further. And I kept going back and starting again, and where I was going wrong was I needed to put a bit of humour in there. I needed to let the main character just act in a way that was a bit silly at the time as kind of a pressure relief thing.
Yeah, it is quite relentless, book two.
Relentless. Yes, okay, that's not really the quote I wanted for the front cover, but you know,
Utterly
relentless by
relentless.
every form.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean it like that. I feel bad now.
No, you have got a point. That was the problem. There's some nasty stuff that happens up to that point, and you, as the reader, know that there's nasty stuff happening at that precise moment, which the main character obviously isn't privy to in the same way.
Yeah.
And so the main character really does need to kind of, I'm going to swear again, so she kind of just needs to go, well, fuck this shit, I'm just going to act like this.
Today's been a swearing episode.
Swearing episode. I'm going to have to mark it as explicit.
If you mark it as, if we're allowed to have explicit episodes, Jules, I won't hold myself in.
No, that's fine.
Jules will tell you I swear a bit like a sailor sometimes, so.
I hadn't noticed because it seems to be about as much as I swear. In all fairness. No, we're both, you know, well-educated women with good vocabularies, fully conversant with all the nuances and subtleties of the English language, but sometimes something does not say it like an F-bomb.
This is true. All right then.
So that swearing, probably a completely different episode.
I want to do an episode on swearing now, Jules.
Yeah, an episode on fake swearing.
Let's do it. Let's do an. All right, guys, we're gonna do an episode all about swearing.
Somehow we will tie that into speculative fiction.
Oh, we'll find a way.
Apparently it's hilarious.
We've reached the quota,
Well, no, I'm quite happy to keep going, but I'm
guys. No,
assuming
no,
that your attention spans are starting to drift
no.
slightly.
Yeah,
So.
no, I think this has spiraled into something silly. Yeah, I think we'll call it. Call
Cool.
it before he gets
Three
any more
goblins walked
ridiculous.
into a bar, and this is the conversation.
All right then, guys. We'll catch you up next week.
Thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.